Good afternoon and welcome to the show. My guest today is Jeff Mall, and he's going to be talking about the great auto race of 1908, New York to Paris. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Well, very happy to be here.
And the reason Jeff is an expert on this is his great-grandfather was actually in it. Isn't that right?
Yes. I know some of your listeners might be familiar with a film that was out a few years ago, Tony Curtis, Natalie Wood, Jack Lemmon, The Great Race, New York to Paris. And what few people realize is that, in fact, that race actually happened. Beginning February the 12th, 1908, Times Square, New York City, destination, the Eiffel Tower, Paris, France. And, of course, you have to remember, in 1908, no automobile had ever driven across the United States in the wintertime, much less the 22,000 miles that they ultimately traveled to Paris.
And whose idea was this? Who came up with something?
Well, it actually was the idea started with the Peking to Paris race in 1907, the year prior. And a Parisian newspaper sponsored that event, the Le Matin in Paris. And what they discovered was the readers, this was sort of like the ultimate reality TV show of that era. Readers would follow the day-to-day advances of their favorite team. That, again, was an international race, as was the 1908 race. And so for a follow-up to that, they had to do something even grander. And they teamed up with the New York Times as a co-sponsor for the race. And the destination and the trip, of course, was extended from New York City to Paris, France. Now, the reason that makes it so unique is their intention was quite literally to drive the entire distance between New York City and Paris. The reason that they started in the wintertime was they had that one little obstruction between the two continents called the Pacific Ocean. In order to take care of a navigable route, they started in winter because they were going to use the frozen Bering Strait as an ice bridge across the Pacific Ocean. When they started from the starting line in New York City, they truly believed that they could do that.
Oh, my gosh.
So now, the competitors, there were international teams. One German team, the German Protos, comprised of German army officers and enlisted men. The car actually was commissioned by Kaiser Wilhelm. The Italian car, which was the Zuest, the youngest team, the competitors in that car ranged from their late teens to early 20s. Three French cars, the Dédion, the Motorblock, and the Césarine Nadine. The American cars, at the time, prior to the race, it didn't look like there was going to be an American competitor. Henry Ford flatly turned down the notion of driving an automobile around the world. Ransom Olds did the same. But you have to remember in 1908 who the president of the United States was. And that was a man by the name of Teddy Roosevelt. And when Teddy Roosevelt heard that there were going to be Italian, French, and German motorists taking horseless carriages across the United States, Teddy didn't really care which U.S. manufacturer to enter a car, but there would be an American entry. And so I guess the polite way to say is that he encouraged E.R. Thomas to enter a car on behalf of the United States, and that ultimately won the race.
And that's a record that still holds today, right?
Yes, 100 years later, that record still holds. Great-grand George Schuster was the only man in the American car, which was actually in the car from Times Square all the way to Paris. There were crew changes along the way, so there were other people who accompanied him, but he was began as the driver. He was the chief mechanic for the E.R. Thomas Motor Company, and he became the driver and in charge of the car in Cheyenne, Wyoming, from there on to Paris. So it was, as you can imagine, quite an ordeal, 169 days to cover that 22,000 miles.
So what did they do when they got to the Bering Strait?
Well, they find that the snow ranged in depths up to 20 feet deep. The race planners had predicted that a crust would form over the snow in Alaska, adequate to support a car. Now, the Thomas Fire weighed over 4,000 pounds, and, of course, on balloon tires, it was impossible. Sleighs would be buried and mired in the snow. When they got to Alaska, they did a little exploring, and they were not only confronted with the snow, but the Bering Strait doesn't freeze smooth like a pond. It freezes into pack ice. But Great Grant was never a man to let any obstacle stand in his way. So he went to the local Wells Fargo company, and he said, "How much will a dog sled carry?" And the agent said, "Well, about 600 pounds. And he said, "Well, that's how we're going to cross the Bering Strait. I'm going to take the Thomas Fire apart into pieces that weigh no more than 600 pounds. We're going to load it onto dog sleds, cross the Bering Strait, and I will reassemble the Thomas Fire on the frozen tundra of Siberia, and off we'll drive to Paris." Now, that was a plan which would have cost $10,000 to go from Valdez, Alaska, where they landed the car. The first automobile in Alaska was the Thomas Fire, and just to get to Fairbanks, and, of course, from there, they didn't have any idea how much it would cost. So the race committee, knowing that all of the cars and competitors would have to be equally funded, decided to avoid that expensive crossing, and this was $10,098, and opted instead to take a steamship across, and they actually landed and crossed Japan and then into Siberia at Vladivostok. But he had every intention of doing it, and if they would have paid for it, he would have accomplished that.
That's just amazing. I would have never thought of that.
Well, I think that this story in particular really points out what people were like and the can-do attitude that they had. Certainly, Yankee ingenuity was alive and well in the early 1900s. And literally, there was no obstacle that they couldn't figure out a solution to. And even today, 100 years later, and I think that's why the record has stood so firmly, even today, nobody has ever, in the case of the Bering Strait, has crossed the Bering Strait in a mechanical vehicle, and they've tried snowmobiles and all sorts of Arctic equipment. But those obstacles are just as difficult today as they were 100 years ago.
And still they try to find a way to do it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that's the human spirit. But these men, and I think that that's the intriguing part of the story, is that this was as much a story about the men as it was about the machines. The technology was there, but those machines would never have made it without, and it wasn't just the American team. I mean, the Germans, Lieutenant Kuppen, extraordinary efforts to keep their automobiles running. They weren't like automobiles today. They didn't have it. There was no roof. There was no windshield. As a matter of fact, on the Thomas Fire, there weren't even doors. And yet they started out in the depths of winter. As a matter of fact, it was one of the worst blizzards crossing New York State that they had experienced since they began keeping records of the weather. And you have to also remember that in 1908, snowplows had not been invented.
Oh.
So they had to shovel, literally shovel, their way across many parts of the states as they went westward. There were times when they would hook teams of horses, sometimes 8 to 12 horses at a time. They would hook onto the front of the Thomas Fire, dragging the Fire through whatever predicament it found itself in. They measured their progress often in feet per hour. That's how slow the progress became in many instances.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
It is. It is. Well, I know that we're going to be in Bradford for the program on Tuesday, and I'm sure you'll fill your listeners in on the details, but these are the types of stories. Great Grant did not pass away until he was the age of 99, and by that time I had the extraordinary opportunity, as few do, to really get to know. We lived in the same small town, and by that time I was into my early 20s, so these stories that I was hearing, by that time I was old enough to fully appreciate, and hearing it from the person who actually did it is a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Was he still alive when the movie came out?
Yes, as a matter of fact, Tony Curtis invited him to the premiere.
Oh.
And he, of course, had a conversation over the phone with Mr. Curtis, and he says, well, what is your film about? And Tony proceeded to tell him, well, you know, we were racing automobiles from New York to Paris, and that was all right. But then Tony went into some of the details, like the now a famous pie fight and some of the things that happened in that film. Very entertaining film. But when Greg Grant heard that, he said, well, that's not what happened. And he actually refused to go to the premiere. He never saw that film. Very entertaining film, but I can understand why. And I'm sure that the audience on Tuesday will fully appreciate why Greg Grant couldn't see the humor in it and chose not to see the film.
Yeah, when you're measuring your progress in feet because you're shoveling that snow, I'm sure you see no humor in that whatsoever.
No. It didn't lend itself to a pie fight, that's for certain.
And so did your great-grandfather have like one favorite story that he liked to tell?
There were so many. There were 169 days of stories, but I think one that is particularly interesting. They had a New York Times correspondent, the race, of course, being co-sponsored by the New York Times, employed a very famous Times reporter by the name of T. Walter Williams, and he was going to ride literally in the back seat of the Thomas Flight from New York to Paris, his mission was to take five photographs per day and then telegraph a story back to New York City, which appeared as front page news for 6 months on the New York Times. T. Walter got to Chicago and said, you are all insane. And he took the train back to New York City. In Seattle, they met up with a replacement reporter by the name of George McAdams, a younger, far more durable reporter than T. Walter was. He was in his mid-20s. And when he arrived at the pier, Great-Gramp met him. And in one hand, he had a suitcase. And in the other hand, he had a crate of birds. Now, Great-Grant looked at McAdams, and he said, what are the birds for? Well, in 1908, there was no communication from the ship back to the shore, so he had to have a way of communicating daily back to the New York Times of the story of the events of that day. And he said, George, those are carrier pigeons. He would tie to the leg of the bird, who would fly back to the telegrapher's office in Seattle, where the story would be keyed back that night to the New York and was then published as front page news the next day. In 1908, that was high tech.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yep, every day was an adventure. Amazingly, of the six cars that started, three of them finished. 50% of the field, which is incredible when you think of that. In those days, nobody had ever even crossed the United States in the wintertime, much less make it to Paris. The other amazing fact was that nobody died in this race. There was illness and all of the things and injuries that they encountered. But this extraordinary feat of man versus the environment, literally in many cases, nobody perished in that effort.
That's incredible. And to my listeners, our listeners, if you want to hear more stories from Captain Jeff Maul about his great grandfather, George Schuster Sr., and the great auto race of 1908, New York to Paris, you can go to the University Room at the University of Pittsburgh at Bradford tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. It's free and open to the public, and it is sponsored by the Friends of the Hanley Library. And gosh, what wonderful stories. Thank you so much for sharing those with us.
It's my pleasure, and certainly we'll have a lot more than for the audience on Tuesday evening.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, 169 days worth, you said.
You got it. And we also have the opportunity to try to provide a little bit of opportunity at the very end for the question and answer. And this program, you don't have to be a car enthusiast to appreciate it. This is definitely a family-type event. And children of all ages really get into it. Matter of fact, I've had a number of youngsters decide to do their history papers. It makes a great subject. It's almost a guaranteed A for them because they will certainly know more about the New York to Paris race than the teacher will.
Good point. And like you said, it's actually a triumph story about the triumph of the human spirit. So
it It is. It is. And it's all true well documented. As a matter of fact, there's a new, brand new, 2-hour made-for-TV documentary that's airing currently in Europe, and it will be United States next year.
Oh, fantastic. I'll be looking forward to that. That's for sure. Okay, once again, Jeff will be at the University Room in the Frame Westerberg Commons tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at the University of Pittsburgh at Bradford. Thanks again for being my guest on the show.
Sounds great. And if any of your listeners would like additional information, there is a website, www.thegreatautorace.com, or they can just Google 1908 New York to Paris, and it'll be the number one Google link there so that anybody looking for additional information can easily find it.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks so much, Jeff.